Now we're going to discuss the title. The subject is Chevron, the importance of Chevron. So here's an opportunity. Whenever we study the Chumash, we're always interested in relating it to our own lives, to the current situation. And here's a case where it's not just relating to us on a personal level, but it's very significant on the political level in terms of the future of Israel. The whole issue of Chevron is extremely important in terms of the ongoing situation. So I think it's significant for Jews, especially Jews who believe in Israel and believe in the Torah, to have an appreciation of what Chevron is all about. Many people can get worked up about something and take a political position about something and say we can never give it up, or we have to do such and such, without even realizing why it's important. What is it, if one were to ask a person, well, why is Chevron so important? What relevance does it have to our lives today? Well, why is it so meaningful? The truth of the matter is that when we talk about the so-called holy places in Israel, the issue of Jerusalem, of making any kinds of concessions in Jerusalem, most people focus on Jerusalem as being the Holy of Holies, and that's, for many people, that's the red line. You can't go beyond that. And I wouldn't argue with that, but in a certain sense, I've made the point that I think Chevron has even more significance in terms of our lives today, and I'd like to try and elucidate that tonight. Interestingly, it's the source would be the Seder that we read this past Shabbos, Chai Yisara. And it starts off with the story of the death of Sarah, and you would think the next thing would be the burial, but something happens before the burial. Of course, Avram comes to eulogize Sarah. That's very important. And he doesn't bury her immediately, but before he does so, he has to acquire a burial place. Now, you would think that that's not such a significant thing for the Torah to talk about. The Torah doesn't get involved in details. It's not a historical work. So it should have simply said that he mourned for her, he eulogized her, and he buried her. But instead, there's extensive description of negotiation to acquire a burial place. And why is this so important? What's the significance of this? If you read through the story itself, you see that Avram didn't have any land at that time, obviously. Because he said, I'm a stranger and a sojourner amongst you. And he asked them to give him a burial site. But he wanted not just a place to bury her, because they came forward. You see, he had acquired a lot of respect. They said, you're a prince of God amongst us, and pick out the choice of burial places and you can bury your wife there. He didn't want to do that. So it wasn't an issue that he didn't have a place to bury Sarah, but he wanted to be given a special plot, a separate plot of land. The most significant aspect of that story is that there's an interesting kind of a negotiation. They want to give it to him as a gift. Ephron, the Hittite, who owned it, he wanted to give it to him as a gift. And Avram refuses to accept it as a gift, and that becomes a big problem for Avram. How can I convince him to take my money? Because they keep going up and back. It's almost like a bit comedic. You know, you see like sometimes people in a restaurant, like, you take, no, I insist, I want to pay, and so forth. But Avram insisted, and not only did he insist upon paying, but he paid a very hefty sum. Abameo shekel keseth, 400 shekels of gold. It's in the money of the time, if you try and calculate, equate it to our money, it comes out to an enormous sum, but he wanted that burial plot. So, of course, the question is, why did he insist upon buying it? Why was this element of acquisition? In Hebrew, it's a kinyan. Why is that so important? If they were willing to give it to him, and it seems like they were sincere, they were serious about the fact that they were going to give it to him. It also mentions that after he paid the money, it says something which is a little bit unusual. He didn't bury her immediately, even at that point. But rather it says that the field was confirmed. The field of Ephron, which was in the Machpelah before Mamre, was confirmed as an acquisition to Avraham Lamikna. The term Mikna means something which he acquired in the full sight of the Hittites, for all that came by the gate of the city. And afterward, after that, it seems that he waited a period of time until the sale was actually confirmed, until it became public knowledge that this field belonged to him. Then he buried Sarah, his wife, in the field of the Machpelah, on the plains of Mamre, that's Chevron. So now we're being introduced to what Chevron is all about. The essence of Chevron seems to be that that's the place where Sarah is buried. Now, why this should be so significant, when you consider all the topics that the Torah takes up, and in general it doesn't really talk too much about death in the Torah, and it doesn't mention too much about burial, so why the whole acquisition of a cemetery, a burial place, should be so important is something which should get our attention. And then even after that it mentions it again, Vayokam Hasada, the field arose. The Hebrew is it arose. It's translated as in the sense of being confirmed. But the commentators mention, maybe close up, please. So it says that even after he buried her there, so the pasuk mentions that the field arose somehow. And now literally it means it was confirmed, but how many times does it have to be confirmed? It indicates that something was elevated. The status of the field, the status of the place was elevated. It reached a new height because of the fact that she was buried there. But it wasn't only a burial place for Sarah, because the purpose was to obtain achuzas keter, a permanent, a field which would be designated in a permanent sense for burial. So that's the first question that confronts us, is what was so significant about this? What was the idea behind it? And why did he insist upon this aspect of acquisition, that he had to pay money for it, and it had to be established, it had to be confirmed, it had to be separate? If you go through Bereishis, the idea of the Ma'aris HaMachpelah is mentioned a number of times, and I just want to go through them briefly, and then to sort of summarize what the idea behind it really is. Of course, you know that the first person to be buried there was Sarah. Who was the second person to be buried in Ma'aris HaMachpelah? Who was the next person to be buried there? Abraham. Yeah. And interestingly enough, it's at the end of Chayei Sarah. It records the death of Abraham. And it says that his sons, Yitzhak and Yishmael, buried him at the Ma'aris HaMachpelah, the field of Ephron. And then it mentions it again, which seems to be really unnecessary, the field that Abraham had purchased from the people of Chet, the Hittites. There, Abraham was buried with his wife, Sarah. So again, it's mentioning, when it's referring to it, it's mentioning as the field which he had purchased. So the idea of purchasing the field is extremely important. Let's continue now. Who was the next person to have been buried in the Ma'aris HaMachpelah? The Yitzchak. Yeah. It doesn't mention that he was buried there, though. We only learn about that at the end of Bereishis, but it does mention the death of Yitzchak. And it's something you should bear in mind when referring to the death of Yitzchak. This occurs when Yaakov returns. After Yaakov was away for 22 years, he was in the house of Lavan, and then when Yaakov finally returns after his encounter with Esav, it says that Yaakov came to his father Yitzchak in Mamre, Kiryat Arba, he Chevron. So Chevron is an extremely important place, and just in a few words, sort of matter-of-factly, it gives you an indication of the importance of Chevron. Asher Gersham Avraham v'Yitzchak. He came to Chevron, where Avraham and Yitzchak had lived, had sojourned. So let's continue now. The next place where we read about the Ma'aris HaMachpelah is in Vayechi, and that's when it talks about the death of Yaakov. There's one person, as you know, that was not buried in the Ma'aris HaMachpelah that we have to take note of. Who was not buried in the Ma'aris HaMachpelah? Who seems to have been left out? It's Rachel. And that's a difficulty that she died on the way as he was returning. And it wasn't that far. He buried her in Beis Lechem. And it was in the Biot Kivras Eretz. It was a short journey. It wasn't that far. So that remains as a question as to what the purpose of that was. And why did it would seem on the surface that Rachel did not merit to be buried in the Maris Machpelah, which is very, very difficult, because she was one of the matriarchs, one of the Mahos. And to the contrary, she's a great tzaddikus, a righteous woman, and all the travails that she went through, and she was the favored wife. That was the wife that Yaakov had chosen. So it's difficult to understand why he buried her in Beis Lechem. And that seems to go contrary to the entire concept of what the Maris Machpelah is supposed to be about. Because if the idea is that this is the burial place of the patriarchs and the matriarchs, so why is Rachel not buried there? So I'm going to try and take that up. All of this comes together in Vayechi. And it talks about the death of Yaakov. And Yaakov gets together with Yosef, and he has Yosef, he solicits an oath from Yosef. And what was the oath? He says that you shall do compassion, you shall act with me in terms of compassion and truth, and please do not bury me in Egypt. So he doesn't want to be buried in Egypt. And he says, and when I die, you shall carry me to from Egypt and bury me in the burial place of my fathers. So that's, you see that Yaakov, it was extremely important to him, to the extent that he solicited an oath from his son Yosef to make sure that he would not bury him in Egypt, but he would bury him in the Maris Machpelah. The reason why he needed an oath was because this was not a simple thing. At this point in time, Yosef would have to receive permission from Paro. And the level of influence that Yosef had at that time was not the same as when he was involved in saving Mitzrayim. So, and also you see that the Egyptians had a tremendous reverence for Yaakov, and that's what he's concerned about, that they might want him to be buried in Egypt. So anyways, he solicited an oath from him. But let's read what takes place later on. Very fascinating discussion, because Yaakov returns to the subject later on, and here for the first time he alludes to the fact that he did not bury Rachel in the Maris Machpelah, and he says as follows: and I, when I came from Padan, Mesa alai Rachel be'eretz Canaan baderach. So Rachel died, so to speak, died on me in the land of Canaan on the road. Biot kivras eretz lavo evrasa, when there was only a short distance from Ephras, and I buried her there on the derech, on the path, on the derech, the road to Ephras. That is Beis Lechem. So at this point in time, he's telling this to Yosef. And of course, as you know, Rachel is the mother of Yosef. So Rashi has a fascinating explanation. Why is he telling him at this point? So let me just read the Rashi to you. When he said, I buried her there, he's saying, I didn't even bring her to Beis Lechem. And I know that you have complaints against me in your heart. He knows that. And all of these years he hasn't explained it to him. This is 17 years since they've been reunited. I know that. So of course, if that's the case, why didn't he explain it to him right away? Why did he keep him in suspense for 17 years? But you should know that I didn't do this of my own accord, that I did this by the word of God, that he had a prophecy from God that this is what he should do. And what's the reason? That she would be a form of assistance to her children when they would be exiled by Nebuzaradan from Babylonia, and then as they were going into exile, they would pass by the way. So now Rashi says something which is very, very strange. And it's one of those midrashim which I don't know if you could take them literally, but we read about it. It says that when they would be driven into exile, Rachel would come out of her grave and she would cry and she would beseech God for mercy. As it says, this is the Haftarah that we read on Rosh Hashanah, Kol Barama Nishma, a voice is heard on high. It is Rachel crying for her children. Rachel Mavake al Baneha. And God answers her and says, there's a reward for what, you'll be rewarded for all that you've done by the word of God, that Vishavu Banim Lug Vulam. And the children will return to their bounty. That was a song, Vishavu Banim. Vishavu, you want? Van, if you want to help us out here. A little musical interlude. One thing, I think there was a song, if I remember, going back to the days after the Six-Day War. If anyone remembers, Re'i Rachel, Re'i? Re'i Ribon Olam? Re'i Rachel, Re'i Heim Shavu L'Gvulam. See, they've returned. So, this idea has a lot of significance, but the question really is, what's it saying over here? It sounds like a crazy kind of an idea. I mean, how are we supposed to understand something like that? Do you mean to say that that as the Jews go into exile, they pass by the grave of Rachel, and Rachel comes out of the grave and she starts crying and beseeching? It's a very difficult kind of an idea to accept. What kind of a significance does that have? The very notion, by the way, that the departed pray for us, that's a very, very troubling kind of an idea. And the idea even of praying at the graves of righteous people is to me something which has to be taken very seriously. In spite of the fact that I regard, of course, going to Hebron and visiting the Maris Malpel as being extremely important, but the idea of praying at the graves of the departed can be a problem. It's problematic. Because to the extent that a person has the idea that he's praying to the deceased, or that the deceased somehow or other intercedes with God, that takes away from the true idea of prayer. The true idea, a person should never imagine that he's turning to any other being. Our concept of prayer is that you stand before God and there's no angel, there's no intermediary, there's no other force that you can rely on. And you're supposed to direct all of your thoughts to the Creator, and to realize that you stand before the Creator, and no matter how absurd it may seem, because how lowly and small we are, God gives us the opportunity to approach Him and to put our requests before Him, and He is the only being that we can turn to. Yes?
I have a comment and a question.
Sure. Can you open the window over?
The comment is, I recently went to an exhibit at the Jewish Museum of Jews in Morocco. And evidently in Morocco, it's accustomed to bury people where they fall, so to speak. Like where they die, that's the place where you bury them. And that also people who are venerated during their lifetime are considered saints after they're dead. And people pray at their graves and make pilgrimages to them. So perhaps this is like an allusion to this. And the question is, do you think that Rachel was not considered worthy to be buried in Hebron because she took her father's household gods with her when she left the town?
Okay, there's a lot of questions over there that you've raised. I'm going to explain. Let me just explain, and I think in the explanation, perhaps the question will be answered of its own accord. If not, I'll come back to it later. Okay. As far as the customs in Morocco, I'm not opposed to the idea of visiting the grave. However, the idea of communicating with the spirit of the deceased, or in any way praying to them or charging them to be emissaries and so forth, these are sort of on the boundary. They seem to tread upon the basic principles that I've mentioned. And that is to say that our relationship to God must be perfect, and we cannot rely on any kind of an intermediary. That's a serious idea, And, you know, we can amplify it at a different time. However, there is great value, as we will see, in visiting the graves of the righteous people, and I'll try and explain what that value is. Let me just read one more source over here, and then I'll try and explain the concept of the Maariv and Hapeilah. Because Yaakov sums up the idea at the end, after he finishes blessing his children, he sums up the idea, and again he issues the command, and he says, I'm about to pass on, and bury me with my fathers in the cave that's in the field of Ephron Achiti, in the cave that's in the field of Machpelah, again Al Pnei Mamre, in the land of Canaan. And again he mentions Ashakana Avraham as Asada, that Avraham bought and acquired the field from Ephron the Hittite as a permanent burial site. There Avraham and Sarah, Avraham is buried with his wife Sarah. There they buried Yitzchak and Rivka his wife, and there I buried Leah. But he doesn't mention anything about Rachel, but he's summing up the whole concept. So now you see that what Avraham was involved in was acquiring not just an ordinary burial place, but something which was to be separate and distinct from the rest of the land that he was sojourning in. In fact, that's the first acquisition. That's the first expression of the Jewish acquisition of property in the land, and in fact, through that, he lays claim to the entire land. That's why it has to be completely separated from them. And a gift doesn't do that. See, when you accept a gift from someone, it's always, that person who gave you the gift is always associated with it in many, many ways. And a gift is always subject to perhaps being taken back. But again, it had to be an acquisition in a manner that it had the sense of being a total possession of the one who bought it, and no association whatsoever. And that's why that's with the one from whom he received it. In fact, whenever you do have a gift, it's different than something you acquired. But you earned it, it's your money, you bought it, it's totally, you regard it as being totally yours. If somebody gave you a gift, whenever somebody admires it, you always mention, oh yeah, that's what someone gave me. It's not, to that extent, it doesn't completely represent you. It's what somebody else endowed you with. And Abraham was concerned that this had to be completely separated from the Canaan who lived in the land. What is the idea of Rachel? Why didn't he bury her there? See, I maintain that in point of fact, she does partake of the idea of the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, if you understand what the concept is. What is the concept of the Maariv HaMachpelah? Why did they decide to have this place where three couples were buried? Well, who are these three couples? These couples are the founders of the Jewish people. The whole identity of the Jewish people revolves around them. And in order to appreciate that, what is the identity of the Jewish people? What is it that unites us? How are we to define ourselves? In Devarim, when Moshe rebukes the Jewish people, and he goes into the question of why it is that God is going to drive out all these nations, and why it is that they're going to be the ones who inherit the land. He says something which is very chilling. He says, do not imagine, when you see that God is going to drive out these nations from before you, do not say that it's because of my righteousness that God has brought me to this land. It is not because of your righteousness or the goodness of your heart that you come to inherit this land. But rather there are two elements. It's because of the wickedness of these nations that God is going to drive them out from before you. So that's a matter of justice. That God did not just decide that he has a favorite, that he likes the Jews better than the other nations. But there's an element of justice. That land was designated for a purpose. And when the corruption, the level of corruption of those nations reached a certain level, so they no longer had any right to live there. Yeah, but that explains why it was not unjust to remove them. But why are you being given the land? It's in order to establish the promise that God swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Yitzchak, and to Yaakov. And he says it again, you shall know that it's not because of your righteousness that the Lord your God gives you this goodly land, for you are a stiff-necked people. This is an extremely significant point, because the question arises, is there any basis for Jewish nationalism? Every nation has a certain sense of nationalistic pride. American, proud to be an American. France, French, British. Every nation inculcates that feeling of nationalistic type of pride. A nationalistic type of pride, the concept behind it is that we have certain superior qualities. We're special, we're unique, we're different. That's basically the feeling of nationalism. I mean, sometimes it reaches the point where it becomes aggressive and superior to others. That's when it reaches an extreme point. The question is there such a thing as Jewish nationalism? Or should Jews feel the same way about Israel, let us say? Should Jews feel the same way about Israel that a Frenchman feels about France, that an American feels about America? Is there such a thing? Is it a valid kind of a thing? I know that many Jews do feel that way. And I know that it's looked upon as being a positive thing. When we encounter Jews that don't care about the Jewish people, that don't care about Israel, it's looked upon as a negative thing. Somehow or other, they're lacking in their Jewishness. But the question is, from the standpoint of the Torah, is that really an ideal? That we should foster a feeling of Jewish pride? On the basis of what I've just read, the question has to be approached very carefully. Because all of these feelings are based upon the fact that we've accomplished something as a nation, that we have a certain status and a certain standing because of our accomplishments. But what Moshe is telling them is that you don't have any right to feel that way. That the fact that you're going to be in this land, and the fact that you're going to be a special kind of society, and the fact that my providence is going to relate to you, really doesn't have anything to do with you. It has nothing to do with you. It has everything to do with the fact of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. It's because it says so in the next sedra, Rak Bavosecha, only in your fathers, Chashak Adoshem, did God have a Cheshek. A Cheshek means a desire. La'ahava Osam, to love them. By Yivcha Bezara, and he chose their children after them, which means that the foundation of this is a very unique kind of a nation. It's different than any other nation. Every other nation is united by other factors, united by land, by culture, by nationalistic considerations. That is not the factor which unites us. What unites us is the fact that we have a common parents, that we're a family, where Klal Yisrael is a family, and a family, the basis of the identification in any family is the fact that you all come from the same parent. And we all come from the same parent. And this is true, by the way, even if you're a convert. Because the Rambam wrote a letter to a convert who had asked him, and by the way, that's the essence of our prayers. When we refer to God, Elokeinu, in our prayers, Elokeinu, our God, Velokei Avoseinu, God of our fathers. So our very notion of God is not something which we have worked out on our own. It's something which was worked out by these three great individuals who discovered the true idea of God, and then they set about to create a system to perpetuate these ideas. And the way that it would be perpetuated would be through a special kind of a nation. That's the arena, by the way, in which God's providence can be seen throughout history. Elokei Hashemayim, God is the God of heaven. Velokei Aret, but God is also the God who manifests his providence in the earth, in a totally different way. That's why I've just been discussing that concept. There are many people that accept the God of heaven and earth. Very interesting idea, because you can't deny, many scientists, you can't deny that the wisdom of God, the heavens are filled with the wisdom of God, the glory of God. So they accept the fact that this universe in which we find ourselves has to have a source, which is outside the universe, a being of infinite wisdom. But they don't accept the idea of the God who intervenes in human affairs. And because the question is there, take a look at all the suffering, take a look at all the misery. How is it possible? The Holocaust and so on and so forth. How could it be if God is also the God of earth? I intend to address that subject and explain to you how Judaism answers that. And if you have the correct premises, you can see the hand of God in human history, the providence. But the essential arena of divine providence in human history is to fulfill the objective of the human race, what the human race was created for, and that is essentially through the entity that he designed for that purpose, that's Klal Yisrael. And if you look at it from that vantage point, you see a tremendous amount of evidence of God, of God's providence throughout all of history. That's the entity that God designed, and the people that he chose. God needed that there should be a certain nation, and the decision was that the most appropriate way to have such a nation would be the descendants of these three giants, each one of whom was unique and achieved the highest possible level of an understanding of our concept of God and how one should relate to God. That's Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And this people defines itself as the B'nai, the children of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So therefore there is no real basis to feel any independent pride, because it's not you. He didn't choose you because of you. And by the way, throughout the difficult situations that the Jews had, even in the sin of the golden calf, when God threatened to destroy the people because they had corrupted themselves with idolatry, which is the worst possible sin, and Moshe Rabbeinu pleaded with God to save them, and God said that I'll destroy them and I'll make a nation out of you. And Moshe always refused that. And he always said, remember the oath that you took to the fathers. To remember the promise you took to the fathers. And Rashi says, if a chair with three legs, a chair with three legs cannot stand before you in your moment of wrath, then how can a chair of one leg stand before you? If you're going to do that, if you're going to destroy them and establish a new nation from me, I'll be the entire thing. It won't work. And that was the correct answer. Of course, God knew that, but the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu was willing to give up that distinction of being the founder in recognition of the fact that the strength of the nation lies in its ability to identify with its progenitors. And the Rambam, as I said, the Rambam points out that even a convert is permitted to say, and should say, our God and God of our fathers, even though you might say that Abraham is not his father. He says that when we refer to Abraham as our father, it's not meant in a biological sense. The Torah refers to a Rebbe as a father. That's what Elisha said to Eliyahu HaNavi when he departed from him, when he died, Avi, Avi, my father, Rechav Yisrael Ufarasha, the chariot of Israel and his horses. He referred to him, that's what the Rambam says, that teachers are referred to as father. Because the ultimate father is the one who is the cause of your existence, and the true existence of a person is not the physical, it's the spiritual existence, it's the perfection of the divine soul. So, he said, anyone who lives the life and has the concept of God of Avraham Avinu, so he can refer to Avraham as his father. It's in that sense that we refer to the others as being our father. So that's the entire basis and foundation of Jewish identity, that we never have lost this idea, that the idea is that we are the children of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. That's, now you'll understand what the concept was. Avraham knew what he was involved in. And he knew that this was the beginning, that he was establishing the foundation of Eretz Yisrael. The foundation of Eretz Yisrael is what God told to him, Lazarecha etnena, to your children I will give it. I will give it to those who are defined as your children. And to those who define themselves as being your children. Because if they break that identification, then they're not entitled to the land. We're only entitled to the land if we conform to that verse, to your children I will give it. That's why the Maaret HaMachpelah has such great significance. Because that creates the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael. Stems from the fact what we read pertaining to Yitzchak, the land Asher Garsham, Avraham Yitzchak. It's the land that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob sojourned in. The fact that they lived there means that they established this particular kind of a lifestyle, which we read about. The pursuit of the true idea of God, the involvement in the compassion, in the fulfilling the will of God, all of this is what sanctifies the land. So they wanted this to be something which was separate and something which would be permanent. The acquisition that he achieved was intended to be permanent, never to be taken away, never to be questioned, never to be denied. And indeed we see that throughout all of history, Hebron remains. Hebron has never been obliterated. The Maaret HaMachpelah remains. It's never been obliterated because that is the heart and soul of the identification of what the essence of Eretz Yisrael is all about. And in that sense, that's the holiness of Hebron. The Maaret HaMachpelah defines the essential characteristic of Hebron, because Hebron, more than any other place, has this character. Of course, Avram went on a journey and he traveled throughout the entire land. And wherever he went, he would build an altar and he would call forth in the name of God. He would teach the true idea of God to people. So, of course, that's what gives sanctity to all of Eretz Yisrael. And that's the reason for all of his journeys. But the specific place, which more than any other is associated with him and with his life, is Hebron. It's the place, Asher Garsham, that Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov sojourned over there. And that's why they chose that particular place to establish something that all future generations, whenever they came to this land, this is the national monument. Because the national monument means that when you come to this country, you come to this land, you discover where this country originates. And this country doesn't begin. It originates with the patriarchs and with the matriarchs. Eretz Yisrael did not exist until Avram came there at the command of God, and he followed the will of God, and he passed all the tests that God had designed for him, which would demonstrate to all of mankind what the proper faith in God demands from a person. And then God said to him, Lazarecha etnena, to your children I will give it. So there had to be a concrete place where everybody could come to and pause. And it's not just an abstract thing. When you're in that, when you're in the presence of the actual burial place. Now I want to get back to that question that was raised before. What is the real purpose of visiting a burial place? And this is something that Jews do in all times and places. You visit the graves of your parents on a yard site perhaps, or some people go before the high holidays. What is the idea behind it? The idea behind it is that we maintain in Judaism that if a person has lived correctly, then he serves as a source of influence to others. That the objective of in following the Torah is to perfect yourself to the best of your ability, and you also have an obligation to use whatever perfection, whatever knowledge and learning you've gained to help other people as well. So you have an obligation to yourself, and you have an obligation to Klal Yisrael, of course, first and foremost to your family, to your community, to whatever extent you can be of help to the Jewish people and to all mankind. Not necessarily, it doesn't have to be only Jewish people. That's the sanctification of God. But you would think that basically your work is completed, that you can only accomplish things as long as you're alive. Once you pass from the scene, that's the end of it. Judaism has a totally different concept. And that is to say that if a person has lived correctly, then he continues to be a source of influence, a source of the good to other people for many, many generations. And this is illustrated in the case the Torah describes pertaining to Yosef. It's a very fascinating case. You know, when Yosef was subjected to the temptation of the wife of Potiphar, you read about that. And the rabbis say that there was a day came when she was constantly imploring him. She wanted to have a relationship with him, and he was rejecting him. But the rabbis say he came to the house to do his work on a given day. According to the commentaries, that was a holiday and there was nobody around. So she used that day to try and seduce him. And the rabbis, some of the rabbis are of the opinion that he too had weakened, that he too was subject to temptation, and that he came there, maybe not consciously, but on an unconscious level, he was battling with this temptation. And the rabbis say that he was about to give in to the temptation, and there flashed before his mind's eye the image of his father, Jacob. The image of his father Jacob flashed before his mind's eye, and that gave him the strength. That gave him the strength to overcome his desire. So the two of them were physically separate. They hadn't seen each other in many, many years. But you see that Yaakov had given him something more than just the teachings, than just the encounters between the two of them. He had created a certain image. And if you've created a certain image, then that image is extremely significant, because at crucial moments in a person's life, he looks for guidance, he needs help, he needs inspiration. And sometimes you can find it in the people around you, but sometimes you can't find it in the people around you. And sometimes the people aren't here, but you call to mind what they stood for, and you remember. And what would they say about the situation? What would their advice be? And you can draw from it, and you can gain strength, so that a person who's lived correctly can be a source of inspiration and teaching, not just while he's alive, but even after he's gone. And that's illustrated in that point. And that's the concept. That's the concept of the Maharas HaMachpelah, that there is a realistic change. We have all the experiences of the matriarchs and the patriarchs, everything they went through, all the sacrifices that they made, all the battles that they went through. It's very difficult to imagine any situation that we confront today for which you cannot find a precedent in the Torah. And that's the famous statement of the Ramban, that the Maaseh Avos, the deeds of the fathers, are assigned to the children. That God worked it out that they would encounter all of the challenges and difficulties and problems that the children would have to encounter throughout history. So you can always find an inspiration, a source for whatever difficulties you are in. If you think about it, or if you come and study with someone, if you want to come, you can study with me, I'm pretty sure I could find a precedent which would be of significance to you. The case which illustrates the significance of the Maaseh HaMachpelah playing a particular role is one that I mentioned this summer as the story of the spies, as you know, and we showed in the Pesukim, that one of the spies separated and went to Hebron. And it happened to be that that spy was Kalev. He was one of two, him and Joshua, who were not drawn along by the conspiracy of the spies. And we know it because God promises that because Kalev was faithful, he would give it to him as an inheritance, the land that he had scouted out. And of course, later on, you read in Joshua that Kalev was given Hebron. So now we know that it was Kalev who went to Hebron. And Rashi says the reason is he prostrated himself on the graves of the fathers so that he shouldn't be seduced by the conspiracy of the spies. So what does that mean? How is prostrating yourself? It means to say that he too was tempted. Everybody is weak and everybody's subject to temptation. But when he was there, the existence of the fathers became a reality for him, and he remembered all the travails that they had gone through. He remembered all of the challenges they had gone through, and he remembered the tremendous faith and the tremendous courage. And more important than anything else is the realization of what they did, of how they dedicated their lives every aspect of their life to the establishment of Klal Yisrael, of the Jewish people, because the Jewish people is the instrument to fulfill the will of God. When he realized that everything that had been done by the fathers and by the mothers essentially had been done for the establishment of this unique entity, which was the will of God, then he had the courage, then he had the power to withstand any kind of a temptation. He was changed into a different kind of a person. All of that because there was a phenomenon of the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. To get back now to the story of Rachel, this is my interpretation. See, in a sense, Rachel too is in the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. If you look at the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, not so much as a purely physical phenomenon, which is located in a particular place, but you look at it as a concept, as an idea, as the idea of eternalizing, of taking the experiences of certain individuals and creating an opportunity to make them eternal in a way that people can relate to them for future generations in a very concrete and real kind of a way, then she is also in the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. She's been separated from the rest because God knew, God communicated to Yaakov that the Jews would have two kinds of existences. That the Jews would have an existence in which they'd have a land of their own, in the land of Israel, which God gives to them as a blessing in order to create a certain type of a society. But that is contingent. Our possession of the land does not belong to us because of any qualities that we have. It's a gift from God given to us as an opportunity to create and fulfill the society that he wants us to establish. And if we fail to do that, if we allow ourselves to be corrupted, then the gift is taken away. And then we exist. The providence of God does not depart from us. It's what I mentioned, it's Hester Punim. God's face is hidden. Which means to say that the only providence is that he doesn't allow us to be destroyed amongst the nations. But then we exist in a state of exile. And the Jews therefore have to have role models. The role models for the Jew in a state of living in the land is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the patriarchs, the matriarchs. A situation would arise when the Jews would be driven out of the land. And you know what happens? When that occurs, you can imagine the total psychological devastation of those Jews who were exiled. It's a rejection. It's failure. It means we're not God's people anymore. It's over. That's what he's concerned about. And that's what the Christian world has said to the Jews. This is a sign that God has despised you, that God has rejected you, the fact that you're in exile. And the Jews themselves would inevitably have to feel that way. There's nothing worse than that. So Yaakov Avinu was concerned that when they were going into exile, they would take this as a sign of total rejection, that we're no longer God's people. And that's why there had to be a role model, an inspiration for the Jews in exile. And that really, there's nobody that's more suitable for that task than Rachel Imenu. Because Rachel Imenu sacrificed her whole life for the Jewish people. As if she was the chosen wife. She was supposed to be the wife of Yaakov. And yet, she was usurped. Her father decided he wanted to marry Leah as well. And as the rabbis say, but Yaakov had given the signs, the special signs to Rachel, because he suspected that he would try and pull some kind of a shtick. And Rachel had the opportunity to stop it, but she couldn't tolerate the fact that her sister would be embarrassed. She wanted to spare from the embarrassment, and she gave the signs of it to her, so she wasn't embarrassed. But nevertheless, she had to endure the fact that she could no longer have Yaakov to herself. She had to share her husband with her sister. And then she had to go through all the travails that her sister had children and she couldn't have children. And all of the suffering, she died young, she died in childbirth. Her entire life symbolized a Jew in a state of suffering, in a state of exile. And indeed, that's why he buried her in a state of exile, so to speak. That she never made it to the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. So when the Jews would, in my opinion, that's the meaning that she comes out of her grave. It doesn't mean that she physically comes out of her grave. It means to say that when they pass by there, they remember the entire history, the entire story of Rachel. And that would give them the inspiration to recognize that the whole existence of the Jewish people is part of a divine plan, and therefore it's indestructible. They can never be destroyed. And the reason for the exile is because of the sins. But once they would return to God, then they'd be returned to the land. Yes?
In fact, Rachel's entire existence was outside Israel. She never lived in Israel.
Right.
Never.
That's a good point.
She arrived and she died.
That's right. That happens to be an excellent point which supports it. Yes. Yes. Now, I just want to conclude that this is, I guess, the topic was Chevron then and now, which to me is pretty much the same thing. in my mind, then and now it's the same thing. I'm living in the then. I'm trying to make now into then. As you know, the recent history of Hebron, the Jews have, you know, with the Zionistic return, the Jews have tried to rebuild Hebron, and there's a bloody history. There was a Jewish community in Hebron in 1929. There was the first of the Arab riots, and they virtually wiped out the entire community. And then some Jews tried to return after the war of 1947. So, of course, it was taken over by Jordan. But then, after the victories of the Six-Day War, so Jewish community was reestablished in Hebron. Now, if you go to Hebron now, there's a small enclave, a very heroic type of a Jewish community that's surrounded by a sea of Arabs, and it's very difficult to imagine how people can live in that kind of a situation. It's claustrophobic, I mean, it's very confined. But nevertheless, it seems to me that of all of the so-called sites, holy sites, whatever term you want to use, there is none that's more important than Hebron. Because the real problem that Israel faces today is, in my opinion, is the problem of Jewish identity. And that the secular Israeli does not really have a sense of identification with the Jewish past. And in fact, that is the problem, in my opinion, of secular Zionism. The problem is that it's an attempt to redefine the essential character of the Jewish people and to make the Jewish people just another nationalistic entity. It's a nation like any other nation, with a certain culture, with a certain history perhaps, and the religion can be part of it, but essentially the objective was to redefine the Jew. And according to the new definition, it's not the people of God, and it's certainly not the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I'll just finish my take questions. In fact, my good friend Rabbi Chait had gone to a meeting in the city, I forget the event, and he had met Arik Sharon, was speaking at this dinner, and he was speaking to a group of rabbis about his own personal commitment to Hebron. He says, where do you find a nation that traces its background all the way to the original parents of the nation, that they all have a common parent? That is the danger. The loss of true Jewish identity, the attempt to foster a different Israeli identity, in my opinion, is the greatest problem from a theological point of view, because if that's the case, there is no real basis. There's no justification for this kind of a people to the land. What is the legitimacy? What is the reason that an entirely secular people that happens to come from some type of a Jewish background but doesn't identify as Jews, what is the right? What is their right to intrude, to come into the Middle East because of persecution in Europe? I mean, basically you can restate all of the Arab arguments. And they themselves feel this difficulty. I believe they themselves suffer from this. And in this type of an argument, once you remove the true basis of the claim that we have to the land, then you're in a very tough kind of a position. And you feel a certain amount of guilt about the fact that you're there. And you don't have any true ideal to fight for. It's very, very difficult, in my opinion, to justify. Well, what indeed is the purpose of having a country like this anyway? What is the reason for it, and what's the ideal behind it? It seems to me that the survival of the Jewish people, of the Israeli, of the land of Israel, has to do with the return to a true identity as a Jewish people. But if you are the Jewish people, so then it's an entirely different picture.
See, if Israelis today try and maintain, well, what gives you the right to this particular land? So it seems to me at a certain point in time you're going to have to go back to history and you have to go back to the Bible, because it says so in the Bible. But then you're vulnerable to one very pertinent question. Do you really believe in the Bible? Do you believe that the Bible is the Word of God? You don't keep the mitzvot, you don't follow the Torah. So if you don't follow the Torah, and if you don't believe that it's divine, so it's just a history book and it's just describing something that happened a few thousand years ago. What pertinence, what relevance can it have for a political dispute today when you're dealing with an indigenous population that have lived there for the last 200 years, and you're talking about a system of self-determination, of rights, of occupation, and all kinds of political concepts which basically are stacked against you. However, if that is not the case, and if you maintain that the Bible is true, that it's the Word of God, and we are the same people. We are the same people that the Bible is talking about. There's no difference between Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and us, because we're their descendants, and there's a chain of continuity that goes from them to us. So then you have every confidence in the world. Then you have no problem whatsoever. Then you don't have any inferiority complex. Then you don't have any guilt. Then you have an ideal, and that's the truth. That's why there should be an Israel. There shouldn't be an Israel just because we need another secular democratic state in that area of the world. And indeed, all it does is create problems. Well, what's the reason? Why do we need all these problems? We can end these problems, very simply. So what do you have to have an Israel for? Why is it so important? There's only one reason why it's important. It's because the Torah is important. Because it's the will of God that there should be a Jewish people. Why? So God's purpose on earth should be fulfilled, that the Torah should exist in mankind, and mankind should live according to the Torah. That's why I believe that it's vital for a nation to have places like Hebron. It makes a big difference to Israelis. Before the Six-Day War, we didn't have it. Fine. We couldn't have it, but there was a yearning. There was a desire for it. Just like there was a yearning and a desire for Yerushalayim and for the Kotel. You know the outpouring of emotion when they broke through and they were able to return to the Kotel. But now that we have it, if we were to give it away, to give it back, that would be undoing what Avram achieved. It was a nitna. It was an acquisition. It was a permanent possession. What right do we have to negate this possession? To undermine this possession? That was his whole purpose, that this would be a permanent fixture. Because this permanent fixture is vital. Every school, every child, all school children should go on tours to Hebron and be taught the story of their history and to relate to these individuals who were the progenitors. That's the way that history should be taught. Well, I mean, that's a whole other thing. I mean, one just maintaining a certain place in and of itself is not going to change the picture. You have to have a whole educational system. But the mere existence of the Ma'aretz HaMachpelah, which is the most significant monument, national monument, not just a monument for history, but something which is vital for today, in my opinion, is of the greatest importance. Now, that's a different issue. As I said, I mean, obviously, if there's a clear-cut case of Pituach Nefesh that it would be impossible to maintain except at the risk of life, then I would agree with you. That outweighs it. That's a halacha kind of a question. But that question applies to all questions of land for peace, which I'm not taking up tonight. I'm saying that we should do everything in our power to support the community, to fight to the greatest of our ability. I personally believe that if the policies and the approach, then it would not be a matter of pikuach nefesh, but that's a different story. I'm not saying that it's that important that we have to sacrifice lives to keep it. The same is true with regard to the Kotel. Rabbi Soloveitchik said that it's not worth even one Jewish life. So saving life comes first. I'm not convinced that that's the case, that that's the reality of the situation. Okay, but that's a separate point. I'm saying that all things being equal, we cannot disregard it. We should support the community that's there and visit when we go there and do everything in our power to encourage people about the vital importance of Hebron and the Ma'aretz HaMachpelah, because the essence of Jewish identity and why we have the land of Israel is tied up with its existence. Okay, any questions?
Yeah. You make a point that it's mainly, you know, secular Jews who are in Israel and that they don't have the religious ties that you might like them to have. But
But on the other hand, you think the Jews are the ones who are in the army who liberated Hebron and Yerushalayim, while the religious students and other leaders do not join the army. And as a matter of fact, discourage their young people from joining the army. I myself have friends in Israel who are quite religious. Their daughter is becoming of the age to join the military, and she's choosing to do so, causing great dismay among her family and friends.
No, that's a definition I haven't agreed entirely. I've been a very big critic of that. I think it's the biggest mistake that the religious have made, that the religious groups in Israel have made, is to not participate, not to join the army. So you're 100% correct. That is wrong. That's a serious criticism of... There are religious Jews in Israel that do serve in the army, and it's called the Hesder program. They study Torah and they serve in the army. That is the correct thing to do. I spoke very strongly against that. And by the way, I don't want to give the impression that I'm criticizing the Israelis or the Israeli soldiers. I'm criticizing the position. I never say that this people are better than the other people. I didn't mean to say that the religious people in Israel are better than the non-religious. I don't believe that, and that's not the subject. That's not the case. I'm not judging people. I'm taking a position. The tragedy, in my opinion, would be that people who are willing to fight and to build, but they themselves don't participate in the ideals which they're truly fighting for. That's what I'm saying. But I don't mean to criticize any group of Jews. If anything, I do criticize the Orthodox, the Haredi Jews, who, as you say, who get the benefits of the country and don't participate in the defense and the building up of the country. So I agree on that point. Okay, we want to have Marv. We can have Marv now.